We're going on to chapter 11, the universal form. Philosophically speaking, there are not so many points here which are of really like critical importance, or at least new points. It's more focusing on the rather spectacular phenomenon of the universal form. So we may go through it a little quickly and then go on to chapter 12, which is very short and is discussing devotion service. So, in chapter 10, at least in the second half of chapter 10, Krishna describes so many of his opulences within this material world. How he is manifest, or at least how his energy is manifest in many extraordinary ways. And when we see these different manifestations, which are so extraordinary, then that can help us to remember him and inspire us to relate those things to him. So now, in the beginning of chapter 11, in the first section, verse 1 to 9, Arjuna begins asking Krishna, if you would please show me the form, show me that form of yours in which all these different features that you've just now described, that they're manifest. I want to see that form. That's described in verse 3 of chapter 11. O greatest of all personalities, O supreme form, though I see you here before me in your actual position, as you have described yourself, I wish to see how you have entered into this cosmic manifestation. I want to see that form of yours. One interesting point that comes out here in this verse 3, and it'll become a little clearer as we go on, is that the two-armed form of Krishna is Krishna's actual form, or his real original form. Other forms, they're subordinate. Other forms, including this universal form which is about to be manifested before Arjuna, that is subordinate. And the four-armed forms, and all the other forms, they're all subordinate to the two-armed form. So Arjuna expresses that in verse 3 by saying, Tvam Atmanam, you yourself. That this is really you, it's you yourself, this two-armed form. But still, he wants to see this universal form, or the form in which all these wonderful opulences that Krishna has just described, the form in which those opulences are actually displayed. So, in verse 5, from verse 5 to verse 9, Krishna agrees, all right, if you really feel you want to see that form, then I'll reveal it to you. It's a very extraordinary form. In verse 6, Krishna says, no one's seen it before. Krishna, it's described in Mahabharata, how when Krishna went one time to Hastinapur, just before the battle of Kurukshetra, Krishna went to try and negotiate peace, a last-minute attempt to stop the battle. But Duryodhana and company, they were not really so interested. And one of the reasons that they weren't so interested was that they didn't really seriously accept that Krishna's God. They weren't convinced that he was God. So in order to try to convince them a bit more, which hopefully would lead them to the point of listening to him and doing what he was saying, giving some land to the Pandavas and avoiding the battle, in order to try and convince them, Krishna showed a sort of like a lesser version of the universal form. Some partial type of universal form. He showed that to Duryodhana. And Duryodhana was amazed. He was quite astonished. Not quite to the same extent that Arjuna is, because it was a lesser form. It wasn't the complete universal form. But he was certainly very astonished. But still he didn't accept that Krishna's God. He said to Krishna, "Oh, that's very amazing. I wonder what austerities and pious activities you performed in your last life in order to get the mystic power to be able to show this form." So it took Krishna to be a jiva soul who had just acted very piously or something of that sort, and thereby he'd got some great mystic power. So this particular universal form which Krishna is about to show, he says no one's seen it. In verse 7 he explains that everything is there, past, present, future. Everything, everywhere is present in the universal form in one place and one time. So it's quite something extraordinary. Then in verse 8, Krishna makes an interesting statement. He says that with these present eyes you have, you can't see this form. So I have to give you a different set of eyes. And he calls these eyes Divya Chakshus, which of course, well, Prabhupada describes, he translates as divine eyes. Generally we understand the term Divya to mean transcendental even. Now, one interesting question that arises in this chapter, or from this chapter at least, amongst so many people in Hinduism, is the question of whether the universal form of Krishna is a higher form than the two-armed or four-armed forms, or not. Those of you who are from Indian backgrounds, you may have heard people, generally the popular understanding is that the universal form is a higher form. And they say that one important evidence for that is that Arjuna couldn't see the universal form with his present eyes, but he needed these other eyes, these Divya Chakshus. Now, our acharyas don't accept that, and there's an explanation. And when we come to a suitable point, I'll explain it a bit. But it is an interesting question. It's definitely an interesting question. Divya Chakshus. Arjuna needed Divya Chakshus to see that form, whereas the two-armed form and also the four-armed form he could see with his own regular eyes. So then, starting in verse 9, the description of the universal form begins. It's in three sections. First of all, from verse 9 to verse 13, it's all explained there briefly in your overview book. 9 to 13 is Sanjay's vision of the universal form. Sanjay is quite impressed. He thinks it's very impressive, but quite nice. Then the second section is 14 to 19, in which Arjuna describes what he sees, or at least Arjuna begins to describe what he sees. And Arjuna is also very impressed, but he doesn't find it as nice as Sanjay found it. Sanjay finds it very colorful and spectacular. So Arjuna also finds it very spectacular, but he becomes gets into anxiety because it's so vast, and he begins to become overwhelmed by seeing it. And then from verse 20 to verse 31, Arjuna sees, or he focuses on, one particular part of the universal form. Not the whole universal form, but one particular part, which is called the Kala Rupa, the form of time, which is part of the universal form. And when Arjuna focuses on this part of the universal form, then Arjuna becomes totally overwhelmed and bewildered, and it becomes too much for him, and he begs Krishna, "Please withdraw this form." So we'll just go quickly through these verses. So Sanjaya is describing from verse 9. He says in verses 10 and 11, it's very wondrous, brilliant, has celestial garlands and garments, divine scents, so it must have smelt very nice, divine weapons, celestial ornaments, very effulgent, verse 12, like hundreds of thousands of suns, very brilliant. Then, 13 is now making a transition over to Arjuna, expressing what he sees. So in verse 14, Sanjaya says that Arjuna, he actually was becoming bewildered by this extraordinary sight. He sees all the living beings, demigods, Lord Shiva, divine serpents, many arms, bellies, mouths, eyes, this is verse 16, no end, no middle, no beginning. Verse 17, he says, I'm finding it difficult to look at this universal form. Because of its effulgence, it's just too much. I'm seeing this form everywhere. I'm feeling totally surrounded by it. So he's explaining like this. In verse 19, blazing fire is coming out of the mouth, burning the whole universe. So a mood of apprehension and anxiety is definitely there. Different from the mood of Sanjaya. He thought it was very nice. It smelt very nice. Nice ornaments and clothing and so on. Then starting with verse 20, Arjuna sees the Kala Rupa, the form of time. Now that form of time, of course, is extremely frightening. Because that form of time is destroying everything. So Arjuna sees a lot of destruction going on. So he says in verse 20 that all the planetary systems are perturbed. They're frightened. So from being disturbed, now he's frightened. He sees in verse 21, he sees lots of demigods. And they're very afraid. Then verse 22 is very interesting. He sees Shiva, the Adityas, these are all demigods, Sadhyas, Vishvadevas. These are all different types of demigods. The forefathers, the Gandharvas. Then he sees some Yakshas. Then he sees some Asuras, demons. So what are these people doing? They're looking at the universal form. Now, this brings us back to this point about Divya Chakshus, the type of eyes that Arjuna was given in order to see this form, and the question of whether those eyes were actually transcendental as such, or some other sort of special type of eyes. Different from normal human eyes, but still not necessarily transcendental. Well, what do any of you think? Any suggestions? Yeah. Well, that's not exactly like psychedelic eyes or something. That's not exactly the point, Drew.
Because the dependence of the form of the house is of sun.
Yeah, that's not quite the point. The question is, did he get spiritual vision, or was it something else?
Arjuna seeing Krishna, he already has spiritual vision. Krishna is there, he's seeing Krishna. But he sees the form, the material form, so he gets a heavenly eye.
That's basically the right idea. I mean, there are a number of points which make it apparent, but the main point, I would say, is that Arjuna sees that there are a number of demons looking at this form. Now those demons, and even the demigods, particularly here, like Gandharvas, Vishvadevas, and so on, they're lesser demigods. They're not on the level of Brahma or Shiva. Yeah, so lesser demigods. Generally we understand that the demigods are not necessarily pure devotees. Actually, most of them are not. And many of them are definitely not, like the Gandharvas. They're heavenly beings, but they're not pure devotees. And now, obviously, the Asuras are not pure devotees. In fact, they're quite the opposite. They're demons. But they already have the vision which it takes to see the universal form, because they're seeing it. And Arjuna sees that they're seeing it, and he sees how they're reacting to that sight. So our acharyas, particularly Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, goes into this subject. And he makes the point that when Krishna said that I'm going to give you divya chakshus, that in this context the term divya does not mean spiritual. Like so many Sanskrit words, divya has a primary meaning, which is spiritual, but then it has a number of secondary meanings. And one of those secondary meanings is celestial, or like on a higher level materially. So this divya chakshus then that Arjuna was given was a higher type of material vision, like a celestial material vision. And therefore he was able to perceive the universal form. But the other people on the battlefield, they weren't, because they didn't have that divya chakshus. But here we see that the demigods, asuras, and so on, they are seeing the universal form. So, this is an important point to bear in mind. Anyway, as we go on, we're going from verse 23 now. Arjuna sees everyone's disturbed, all the demigods are disturbed. This terrible sight with terrible teeth, gaping mouths, his mind is becoming overwhelmed by fear. He can't even maintain his steadiness. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur makes the point that because Arjuna was a Kshatriya, at least he didn't run away and try and hide. At least he stood there and sort of went through the whole thing, even though he was beginning to collapse. And he was just, it was too much. At least he didn't try and run away or just completely lose his mind. But definitely, it was much more than he could take, and he was just losing his clarity of thought. 25 talks about the blazing, death-like faces and awful teeth. And then in 26 and 27, he sees the scene on the battlefield. All the soldiers are running into the mouths of this particular feature of the universal form, and they're all getting chewed up. Very ghastly sight. Twenty-eight gives a somewhat poetic description of these warriors rushing into the mouths of the universal form and being chewed up. Like rivers running into the ocean. And then in 29, as moths fly into a fire. So our acharyas explain that rivers flowing into the ocean, this is a nicer type of concept. And this applies to the warriors like Bhishma, who are actually great devotees. But the moths flying into the fire and getting burnt up, it's rather ghastly. So that's describing how Arjuna sees Duryodhana and Dushasana and the demons being killed by the universal form. Then finally sees everyone is being devoured. It's like total destruction is going on. That's in verse 30, and then in 31, he asks Krishna two questions. Who are you? Who are you, and what is your mission? What are you doing? So now we switch over to Krishna, starting with verse 32. So who is Krishna, or at least this, who is this particular feature of Krishna that Arjuna is seeing? Kalosmi, time I am, the destroyer of the worlds. And I've come here to destroy everyone. Prabhupada made the point that everyone should bow down before God. But an atheist is a person who will specifically refuse to. As a matter of principle, he'll refuse to bow down before God. But Prabhupada said that when God comes before this atheist, in the Kala Rupa, in the form of time, then that atheist will immediately offer full dandavats before the Supreme Lord. Without any reservation, he'll just fall at the feet of the Kala Rupa. Everyone, there's no escape. There's a famous slogan. I don't know if any of you studied philosophy at university. There was a French philosopher called Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre, who died a few years ago. And then he had a friend or someone connected with him called Nietzsche, who was German. And I think it was Sartre. Anyway, they're both very fond of the saying that God is dead. They thought God was dead. And they made, you know, a big thing about trying to explain philosophically how God was supposedly dead. So there's some famous graffiti in the subways in New York some years ago. Someone wrote God in big letters, like right across the whole wall. God is dead. Signed, Nietzsche. Then a few years later, Nietzsche died, but the graffiti was still there. And someone else came along and wrote underneath, Nietzsche is dead, signed God. So this is the time form, Kala Rupa. It devastates everything, including the whole material world, the planet that we're on, the whole universe. Everything gets destroyed by what? The Kala Rupa. So that this Kala Rupa is like the embodiment of everything horrible. Everything which is really unattractive is there in the time, in the form of time. So then, in verse 33, Krishna goes on to encourage Arjuna that don't worry. You should fight because you can see how powerful I am. And I've already arranged that you're going to win. So you just have to go through the motions of fighting and you'll come out successful. So don't worry about it. Just be my instrument and fight. And don't be so mental about the whole thing. Verse 34 says basically the same thing. All these great warriors that you're afraid of, or you're afraid that you're going to be responsible for killing or something like that, I've already killed them. So you're just going to be an instrument. You're not going to be responsible. Don't be disturbed. Just fight. Just do your duty and fight. And everything will work out fine. Then section D, Arjuna offers prayers from verse 35 to 36. First of all, from 35 to 40, Arjuna expresses his highly emotional state of mind. He's just astonished, completely overwhelmed, with a faltering voice. He's speaking, he's trembling. He's offering obeisances again and again, glorifying the Lord in all sorts of nice ways. Verse 39, he says, I offer my respectful obeisances to you 1,000 times, and again, and yet again. Then verse 40, obeisances from the front, from behind, and from all sides. So he's really offering obeisances. He's really, really offering his obeisances in quite a big way. Our acharyas explain that Krishna was thinking, Arjuna rather, was thinking that look at this universal form. It's so great, so I must offer something to Krishna to somehow appease him or placate him or something like that. I must offer something. But then he was looking around in the universal form and he saw that everything which I could offer is part of Krishna. So what can I offer to him? It's already part of him. So then he thought, well, the only thing I can offer then is my obeisances. So then from all sides, back, front, again and again and again, he was just offering his obeisances. It was just completely devastating for him. Completely devastating. Then from verse 41 to 46, Arjuna is expressing his own feelings, like his own heart. From 35 to 40, he was glorifying Krishna. Now from 41 to 46, he's expressing his own attitudes and his own feelings. So first of all, in verses 41 and 42, he expresses that he apologizes. I was so familiar. I was saying, hey Krishna, hey Adana, hey Sakha, hey Sakha. Oh Krishna, oh Yadava, oh my friend. But I didn't, and I thought you were just my friend, my cousin, but now I see what you really are. So I'm sorry I was so familiar with you. Our acharyas explain that when he says that I used to say, hey Krishna, then he didn't say Sri Krishna. He just said Krishna. Like if you go up to your spiritual master and say, just refer to him by name. You don't say Srila such and such. Then it's not so nice. So Arjuna's feeling like he's done that. Hey Krishna, you're my friend. So what he says, what I was thinking when I addressed you like that, is that you are Krishna, the son of Vasudeva, and Vasudeva is one of our ministers. So he's a lesser Kshatriya, which, strictly speaking, according to Varnashram, is true. Vasudeva was in the position, according to Varnashram, he was a Kshatriya, but he was a lesser Kshatriya. He wasn't a king, he was a minister. So I was, when I was calling you, oh Krishna, I was thinking that, oh, there's Krishna, the son of Vasudeva, who's a lesser Kshatriya. So I'm sort of doing him a favor by being so nice to him. Hey Yadava, I was referring to you as a member of the Yadu dynasty, and the Yadu dynasty, they are lesser Kshatriyas, and they are beneath us. The Kauravas, they were ruling the whole planet, and the Yadus, they were kings in just one small portion over in Gujarat there. Just one small portion. So I was referring to you as being a member of that lesser Kshatriya family, as if you were less than me. And hey Sakha, oh my friend. I was thinking that even though you're in a lesser position, but still I'm being very nice to you by being friendly to you. So I'm very sorry for that. So he goes on like that. In verse 44 he expresses many different types of attitudes. He's feeling, he says, that you should forgive me or tolerate me as a son is tolerated by a father, as a friend is tolerated by a friend, or even as a husband is tolerated by his wife. So he's sort of manifesting different rasas, the attitudes of different rasas. Actually, Arjuna's position is quite interesting. He's in the friendly rasa, but there are two divisions of the friendly rasa, Sakya rasa. One is the friendly relationship like the cowherd boys have with Krishna, where they're in fact, sometimes they say to him, "Hey, what sort of big man are you? You're not very strong. We can beat you in wrestling." There's one story which I know some of you have heard. Krishna, well, the cowherd boys, they wrestle a lot. So Krishna, they challenge each other, and Krishna, he gets involved sometimes. But because they're his devotees, Krishna lets them win many times. Many times he lets them win. So they think, oh, Krishna, he's not very strong. So sometimes they have team wrestling matches. Two of the cowherd boys becomes the head of two different teams, and they choose who's going to be on each team. Then as they're in the middle of choosing, one of them says to the other, "Hey, why don't we choose Krishna for our team?" But the other one says, "No, we don't want Krishna on our side. He always loses." So it's like that. There's no formality. It's just a very intimate mood of loving friendship. Then there's another division of Sakya-rasa, which is a friendly relationship, but in a formal mood. In a formal mood. Like a good example is Krishna's children in Dwaraka. Now, of course, he's the father and they're the sons or daughters. But this relationship is considered a division of Sakya-rasa, in which God is the father and the devotee is the child. It's a division of Sakya-rasa. Because there is a type of intimate affection, which is, you know, there's a friendly element to it, definitely. But still, the father is always the father. And no matter how friendly the relationship gets, the father remains the senior member. So that's an example of this lower division of Sakya-rasa. Now Arjuna, he is actually in between the two. So sometimes he's very intimate and friendly, like he was expressing, as we described a few minutes ago. "Hey Krishna, hey Yadava, hey Sakha." But then sometimes something happens and he realizes, wait a minute, this is God. This is not just my friend or my cousin, this is God. And then he laments, "My gosh, what have I been doing?" Getting familiar with him. So he's in the middle. So now he's just slipped into that formal type of mood due to seeing the universal form. Then, uh, 45 and 46, Arjuna's requesting Krishna, "Please withdraw this form." He says, "I want to see you in your forearmed form," in verse 46. "I want to see you in your forearmed form." Then we go on to the last section, 47 to 55. So 47 to 48, Krishna withdraws the universal form. He doesn't just do it immediately. It's only in verse 49 that he actually withdraws the form. In 48, he does say, though, that no one before you has seen this form. You can't see it by studying the Vedas or yajna, charity, piety, penances. You can't see this universal form. Then he withdraws the form in 49. And then suddenly in verse 50, so we understand he goes through from the universal form to the forearmed form. And even though it's not specifically stated as such, by the time we reach verse 50, Krishna, at least by the end of verse 50, Krishna is actually showing his two-armed form. Now how do we know that? Because in verse 51, Arjuna, now feeling a little more settled, Arjuna says that now I'm seeing you in your Manusham Rupam, your human-like form. Now we generally don't see many humans with four arms, so we can assume that he's actually seeing the two-armed form. Now, Manusham Rupam. Then Krishna in verse 52 makes an important statement that this form that you're seeing now, that means the two-armed form, that this form is very difficult to see. Even the demigods can't see it. Now this is a very interesting distinction between the universal form and the two-armed form. The universal form the demigods could see, but Krishna says that the two-armed form the demigods can't see. Now of course in one sense they can see it, but in another sense they can't really see it, in the sense that they can't see it for what it is. They're prone to think that Krishna's just some ordinary person. So that now this vision, to see or perceive Krishna to be what he is, meaning to be the Supreme Lord, that takes, it's not like a different set of eyes like what Arjuna was given. Or like, you know, if you get certain types of glasses, some people who can't see well, if they wear glasses, then they can see things. It's not like some physical appendage which you add. But we're referring to a quality of consciousness. With a certain quality of consciousness, one can perceive who Krishna really is, meaning the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and not just some ordinary little cowherd boy. So when Krishna says that the demigods can't see this form, or they're always wanting to see it, it means that they don't have the spiritual, devotional quality of vision to see. Because actually they were seeing Krishna when he was walking on the planet. But of course we know that sometimes they didn't really see him to be what he was. Brahma even became bewildered, even Indra became bewildered. Even Shiva became bewildered once and fought with Krishna. So even the demigods, they found it difficult to really see Krishna for what he really was. Then verse 53, it's more or less like a repeat of verse, 48. That You need transcendental vision, a certain type of vision, to see this two-armed form for what it really is. And how do you get that? Verse 54 explains very nicely. It's an important verse. You can get this type of vision only by ananya bhakti. We've mentioned this term ananya on numerous occasions now. Here it crops up again. Bhaktya tvananyaya sakya. Only by undivided, undeviating devotional service can you really see this form. And only in this way can you enter into the mysteries of my understanding. Then verse 55, Krishna sums up by saying that therefore you should engage in pure devotional service. And then you'll come to me. I think we'll go on a little bit into chapter 12. It's a bit of a change of subject. But we have to move on because we don't have enough days to give each chapter one full day. So now, this chapter 12 is the last chapter of the second section of Bhagavad Gita, this most important section. So now we've noticed that At the end of chapter 9 and in the beginning of chapter 10, Krishna established some very high devotional principles of pure bhakti. But then immediately, like about one third of the way or halfway through the 10th chapter, suddenly we switched into like heavy awe and reverence, extremely heavy awe and reverence, from that mood of affection and love and personal concern and intimate dealings and so on. It turned into a whole discussion about opulence and power and death and destruction and everything, fear. So now Krishna wants to bring the subject back to bhakti, pure devotional service. So he does that very nicely in this chapter 12. Now the first section, which is from verse 1 to verse 7, it's very important philosophically, because here in these verses Krishna establishes very clearly, beyond any doubt, that personalism is better than impersonalism. As I said some days ago, this debate, personal, impersonal, does the absolute have a form or no form or like that, this has been an ongoing debate ever since there have been conditioned souls, probably. You know, it wasn't just Shankaracharya who thought up this idea that maybe the absolute is impersonal. No, it's been there. It's just been there since the beginning. So here Arjuna brings up the question. Which is better? Devotional service or the worship of the Aksharam Avyaktam, the absolute which is unmanifest and beyond the senses, the impersonal. So which is better? And Krishna in verse 2 gives a very straight answer. Quite honestly, I don't know how the people like Shankaracharya, who did comment on Bhagavad Gita and so many other impersonalists, how they could possibly come out of reading Bhagavad Gita thinking that it's advocating impersonalism. Because this verse states it so clearly, that those whose minds are fixed on my avation, upon me, upon my personal form, and who are always nitya yukta upasate. Upasate means worshipping. Shraddhaya, with great faith. They are yukta tamaha. They are the most perfect. So it's very clear. Krishna is saying personalism and bhakti, they are the highest concepts. But in order to encourage the impersonalists a little bit, Krishna speaks verses 3 and 4, that those who do worship the Brahman or try to realize the Brahman, the impersonal feature of the Absolute, then they can achieve me. He says at last they can achieve me. Not now, not quickly, but sooner or later, at last they can achieve me. Now what does this me mean? Does that mean Krishna in person? No. How could it? Because we just read about 2 or 3 minutes ago, Krishna said that the only way you can realize me is ananya bhakti. So through worshipping the impersonal absolute, how are you going to realize Krishna in person? You're not. So what does Krishna mean by when he says that at last they achieve me? He means they achieve me in my impersonal feature, Brahman. Because as we mentioned a few days ago, Brahman and Krishna, they are one. It's not that Krishna is one thing and Brahman is another and you are another and someone else is something else. No. Brahman and Krishna are one. As Bhagavatam states, Vedanti tat tat bhavaras tattvam yaj jnanam advayam. Material bodies. Why? Because when you have a material body, you're existing as an individual, as a person. But this impersonal absolute, or realizing it, means no personality. You have to give up your personality. You have to give up being a person. Having a body, being a person in the material world, means you have feelings and relationships and activities and your own goals in life and so on. But merging into the impersonal absolute means all those things are finished. So it's very difficult to give up all these personal concepts and these personal aspects of our lives, because we're so used to them living here in the material world. So therefore, for those people who have material bodies, to achieve this impersonal realization is very hard. It's only achieved, he says, avyakta hi gatir dukkha. Dukkha actually can be translated to mean misery. That there's a lot of misery involved in realizing it. It's not easy at all. And then what to speak of the fact that we have material bodies making it difficult. But we understand that even spiritually we're individuals. And spiritually, as individuals, we have our relationships and feelings and so on. So not only does impersonalism contradict our material nature, ourselves as we know ourselves at this point, but it also contradicts our eternal spiritual nature. So that makes it even more difficult. But if you really want to do it, then you can. But don't expect it to be easy, and don't expect it to be much fun. Then in verses 6 and 7, Krishna now contrasts the achievement of the devotees with this whole achievement and the process of achievement of the impersonalists. So for the devotees, Hur ananye naiva yogena mam dhyayanta upasate, undeviatingly absorbed in bhakti yoga, meditating on Krishna's form, then what? Krishna says, for them, I'm the swift deliverer from the ocean of birth and death. For the impersonalists, it takes a long time and it's a big struggle. For the devotees, it's very nice, as we read in chapter 9, verse 2, Susukham, it's always blissful from beginning to end. It's always blissful and more blissful. And it's very quick. But for the impersonalists, it takes a long time. It's a big struggle. There's so many difficulties. So, obviously, Krishna is advocating devotional service to himself. This is really much, much better. So we'll carry on from here tomorrow. Any comments or questions, Dr. James? Yeah, they are. Yeah. Well, you know, even we have something in common with Krishna. So the universal form certainly has certain things in common with Krishna himself. But to draw like a total parallel is really taking it too far. You know, it is a form of Krishna, so as a form of Krishna, it's certainly something very special. You don't just see it just like that. But, you know, there are big differences between the universal form and Krishna's two-armed form. One of the main differences is that when Arjuna saw the universal form, it was horrible. It wasn't nice. But when Arjuna is seeing the two-armed form, he's very happy. It's such a beautiful form. It's so wonderful. And in order to see the universal form, Arjuna had to be given a certain type of vision, a celestial material type of vision, which is like the normal vision even of the big demons. So that doesn't really say much for it. Whereas to get this vision to really properly see the two-armed form, one has to have bhakti, which means that a devotee is a very pure-hearted person and a very wonderful and qualified person. So, you know, there's really considerable difference. But it's a fact. To see the universal form is no ordinary thing at all. Definitely not. As I understand, they didn't see it. In fact, they were wondering, what on earth is Arjuna doing? Collapsing. You know, he's really in a bad way now. Yeah. Yeah. No, they couldn't, as far as I understand, they couldn't see the universe form. It was only those who had celestial vision who could see it. They're standing there wondering what's going on. Why is Arjuna acting like this? Something like that. Is it? Okay. Well, I'm not quite sure, but it's a fact that it wasn't just available for everyone to see. Not at all. Interesting.
And 13 verse of 11th chapter. Because I understand from this purport that Arjuna could see many universes. Because Prabhupada, but maybe I don't have proper understanding. It's on 164 page, Prabhupada said that as we learn from Vedic scriptures, there are many universes and many planets. Some of them are made of air, some of gold, some of made of jeweler, some are very great, some are not so great. Sitting on his chariot, Arjuna could see all these.
Yeah.
As from this, it implied that Arjuna could see many universes.
Well, it would appear to me to indicate the planets. There are some earthly planets and planets made of different things. As I understand that there aren't universes made of these different things, but there are certainly planets, like this planet is mainly Earth. Yeah, but there are not many universes that are made of Earth, and then some that are made of gold. There are planets, though, made principally of certain specific elements. And also in the verse, Sanjaya is saying that Arjuna saw this universe, basically. Unlimited expansions of the universe situated in one place. That's how I understand it. That's how it appears to me.
You're explaining how the universe could understand Krishna's two-armed form as being represented by God. How do you understand that they could universally look at their words?
Yes, no, I wasn't saying that they just can't, but it's a fact that sometimes they find it difficult. Oh, well, I gave examples. You know, like the Brahma Vimohana Leela, when Indra fell into illusion, when Lord Shiva was fighting on the side of Banasura, then they all forgot who Krishna was. Yeah.
And the difficulty is that the rest of the universe.
Now, generally, they would think this is Vishnu. This is an incarnation of Vishnu. But except Vishnu knew. But even Vishnu found it hard to see Krishna. Just one thing before we finish. I want to give you some more verses so you can start working on preparing for our next test. Get your pens ready. Put yourselves into high gear, because I'm going to read out a list of verses. I just want you to write down the verse numbers. And for our next test, I want you to learn four. Next test means a week from tomorrow. Okay, are you ready? Where did we get up to? It was the end of chapter 7, wasn't it? Okay, so chapter 8. So, pens poised. Verses 5, 6, 8, 15, 16, 20, 21, 22. Chapter 9. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 22. 23. If any of you falling behind here, just shout. 24, 25, 26, 27, 29, 30, 31, 32, 34. Just learn all of them, it's okay.
When you said 10, 11, you meant chapter 10.
No, chapter 9. This is all chapter 9. So now we're going to chapter 10. Chapter 10. 2, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. 11. Chapter 11, rather. Verses 53 and 54. Chapter 12. 2, 5. Chapter 13, verse 23. Chapter 14, verse 4. Chapter 15, 6, 7, 15, 18. Are you all keeping up? Chapter 16, verse 7. Chapter 18, 42, 54. 55, 61, 65, 66, 68, 78. Now I'm giving you all these verses because, as I explained earlier, in my opinion, for what it's worth, I feel these are the most important verses in Bhagavad Gita. Now you can learn as many as you like, learn them all, but we want you to know four. Any four, it's entirely up to you, but any four of these verses for our test, which will be 1 week from tomorrow. No, I didn't take any from there. So please, for tomorrow, read the rest of chapter 12 and read chapter 13. Srila Prabhupada, kid.